originally born in Mexico and grew up in the US. Sort of. Did his PhD at Caltech, California Institute of Technology. Recently we came here about 4 months ago, approximately. So we did research in the area of quantum information, which includes quantum teleportation. So he's going to talk about teleportation through the next hour. So, Carlos.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we have a very, very special lecture today because at the end we're going to have an experimental demonstration of teleportation in addition to learning about the theory of teleportation. For the experimental part, of course, I'm going to need a volunteer from the audience. Can you tell the audience your name, please? Can you tell the audience your name, please?
No.
I'm not going to be able to do that.
It's Kumar.
So our brave telenon for today is, how do you spell that?
K.
K-M-A-R. Close enough. Kumar? Okay. So, you know, say goodbye to Kumar, you'll be teleported at the end of today's lecture. But before we do that, we're going to have to learn about the theory of teleportation. So what is teleportation? Well, roughly speaking, I'm going to have a lab A. I'm going to have a lab B. Each lab is going to have a box. I'm going to put objects inside the box in lab A. My goal is to have those objects moved over to the box inside lab B. Now, for the moment, let's forget everything we know about quantum mechanics. Let's imagine the world is purely classical. Can we do teleportation?
No.
Yes, no. The answer is yes. And the solution is called a truck. It's very simple. I take the cargo from this box and load it onto the truck. I drive the truck over to lab B, unload the cargo, and presto exchange-o, I have teleportation. Okay. That's maybe not what you had in mind when I said teleportation. So let's change the problem a little bit. Put a wall between the two labs. Now no trucks can get through. They can't drive around. It's very, very big walls. Such a big wall that in fact it separates lab A and lab B into two separate universes. Can we do teleportation now?
No.
No. Why? Because they're two separate universes. There's no way to get from one to the other. That's what two separate universes roughly means. Yes, question.
We send information between them?
No, because they're two separate universes. But that's a good question, because we're going to change the problem again. And what we're going to do is we're going to add a telephone. And so now, using our telephone, we can indeed send information from universe A to universe B and backwards. Now, can we do teleportation?
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No, no, yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. What do I call the machine that does teleportation?
A fax machine.
A fax machine. Thank you very much. That is correct. What am I trying to build? A giant three-dimensional fax machine. I mean, sure, it's a giant three-dimensional fax machine, but it's a fax machine. Everybody knows what a fax machine does. So what are we going to do? We're going to put, you know, poor Kumar into the box here. We're going to fax him over to lab B. Is that good? Is that what we want to do? Is there any problems?
And we have
phones. Yeah,
exactly.
Which
some may say it's two Kumars too many.
One Kumar too many, but it's definitely one Kumar too many.
So what can we do? How can we fix this problem? So we're going to have a fax machine connected to this box. And it's connected to here. We had a fax machine over here. We're going to go to Staples and we're going to buy a shredder. They're going to attach it to the fax machine. And it's going to be attached, that's at the input of, you know, the fax machine in Lab A always goes to the shredder. So now, after Kumar gets faxed from Lab A to Lab B, he gets shredded. Will that be painful for him? Probably yes. But that's only for the one that's sitting here in this room. The copy of Kumar that teleports to Lab B will be perfectly fine. See, from his perspective, he enters the box, he appears over here, walks out the box of Lab B, and he doesn't feel any pain. It's only the one that happens to be sitting in this room, the original copy, who is going to go through feeling pain for being run through the shredder. But, you know, that's why I asked for a volunteer. Okay, are there any other problems with this scheme?
Yeah, how do you send a person through a phone line?
Well, I basically measure. I do exactly what this fax machine does. I measure them, send the information, and reconstruct it. We'll talk about that in a second. Let me get back to that question. Yes?
When you shred them, you're not actually getting rid of the
Oh, okay, fine. That's a good point. After shredding them, I'll burn the pieces and throw them into a black hole. Now, here's the other problem that you really should be worried about. Have you ever tried faxing anything?
Yes.
Does the copy come out in very high quality?
No.
What kind of quality of whom are we going to get on that meal? Okay. We're getting a bad copy of them. So maybe that's not ideal. But fax machines were invented a very long time ago when they couldn't do, you know, good photocopies. In principle, we could build a really, really good fax machine today. And we could produce a really, really good copy of Kumar on the other side. Would that be enough? Well, it's never going to be perfect. But I'd say yes, that's good enough. And the answer is actually very simple. Why is it good enough? Well, let's say we put them in let's go back to the original idea. We're going to transport them by truck. We're going to put them in a tiny box inside a very warm truck and drive them for 3 hours from Lab A to Lab B. In that time, he's going to be shaken. He's going to sweat a little bit. There's going to be dust that's falling on him. Maybe some cosmic rays will come in and hit one of his atoms somewhere. Roughly speaking, the Kumar that arrives at Lab B will be slightly different from the Kumar that left Lab A, even if we transported them by truck. But that's okay. Nobody ever complains about that. So why should we worry about that when a fax machine is transmitting over? So we should be willing to accept some small amounts of errors, as long as those errors are not terribly noticeable. As long as he's roughly smiling and doesn't completely fall apart in the first hour, that's good enough for us. Okay. So the question is, can we build this fax machine faster, as described?
Yes.
And I would claim the answer is yes. I'm not saying that it's easy. It would be an incredibly difficult feat to produce a giant, three-dimensional, super-accurate fax machine. But it's really a problem of engineering. It has nothing to do with physics. It's simply how good of a fax machine can we build? In principle, we should be able to do it. But now, you've been sitting here for a week or so, learning about this thing called quantum mechanics, and we realize, okay, the world is not classical, the world is quantum mechanical. So what is a fax machine supposed to do? Well, a fax machine does three things. The first one it does is it measures the state of the object that goes into it. The second thing it does is it transmits the information of what it measured over the phone line, and the third thing that it does is it reconstructs on the other side an object that looks just like the original one in that way. What's the problem with this scheme in quantum mechanics? Measurements. We cannot measure things properly in quantum mechanics. There's a thing called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. What does the Heisenberg uncertainty principle say? It says if I know the momentum of the particles, then I don't know the position of the particles. If I know the position of the particles, then I don't know the momentum of the particles. So now we're trying to build a giant packaging. We're trying to teleport Kumar, and we're measuring him, and we start by measuring all the positions. But now that we've done that, we can't measure the momentum anymore. So he's flying at super high speeds on that beat. That's not particularly very good. Or we measure the momentum. And now we can't find out what his position, the position of all his atoms are. So it's completely assembled in some crazy pattern. Or maybe we could do a compromise. We measure some, for some atoms, we measure the position. For some atoms, we measure the momentum. But even so, that's never going to give us enough information to reconstruct Kumar on the other side. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle guarantees that no matter what measurement we choose to do, we will never obtain enough information to reconstruct even a moderately good copy of lab B. So it appears that before even running him through the shredder, I've already destroyed the only original copy of Kumar without obtaining enough information to reconstruct from the lab B. We're very sorry. Okay. Does that make sense? So, for a very long time, people looked at this and said, okay, well, tough luck. Teleportation is impossible in the quantum world. In fact, people said this for approximately 70 years. 70 years after the discovery of quantum mechanics, people still thought that quantum teleportation was impossible. But then, in a paper, in a 1993 paper, by Charlie Bennett and five other collaborators. Let me make sure I spell that name correctly. Bennett plus five. They basically proved that although this, maybe this obvious way of doing teleportation doesn't work for the quantum world, there is an alternative way of doing quantum teleportation that does in fact work. And that's what I'll be talking about today. Now, okay, I have a confession to make at this point. We can't actually teleport people, at least not yet. So Kumar is safe for another day. what we've realized, however, we can teleport small objects. But even with regard to large objects, I think this is really interesting. Because we went from a state when we thought, okay, teleportation is impossible in principle, to a state where we say, okay, it's impossible in principle. It's just probably very, very, very hard. To make the distinction clear, traveling faster than the speed of light is impossible. Traveling at, say, 99% of the speed of light, it's just very hard. Teleporting a person is very, 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 very hard. Now, every once in a while, some person from the army will come and visit us and say, hey, quantum teleportation, that sounds really exciting. Can you build us one of those devices? Maybe we can, you know, teleport our troops around more efficiently. So we got to go and explain to them, well, no. You know, we can do this. We can do this. But we can do this in theory. We can't actually do this in practice. You know, we're happy, we're theoretical physicists. We don't really care if we can do this in practice. But they always seem a little bit disappointed by this. Not sure why. But this is basically the result that I want to tell you about today. We can teleport things in principle, even if we never actually get around to teleporting real people in practice. So what does it mean to teleport something in a quantum world? Well, what's the setup? It sort of roughly looks like this. There's a lab A, there's a lab B. There's a box in lab A, there's a box in lab B. We're no longer going to have a fax and a shredder. That was what we had in our classical world, so let's delete that. But we're still going to have the same phone. And there's also going to be that wall that separates the two universes so that they can only communicate from one place to the other via the phone. Now we have to first talk about a small technicality of quantum teleportation. The question is, what kind of phone should that be? It turns out that once you're in quantum information, there are two kinds of phones. There are quantum phones and there are classical phones. A classical phone is a standard phone, the same kind of phone that you might find at this, in the side of the room. A standard phone is a cell phone. A classical phone is any phone you might have seen up to now. A quantum phone is a phone that can also send quantum information. It turns out that if the phone here can actually send quantum information back and forth, then the problem is trivial. It's kind of a, it's kind of just like the case when we had the truck and we're moving trucks, goods back and forth with the truck. We don't really want to allow the truck, and we don't really want to allow our quantum phone. So we have our quantum teleportation, and it's just like that, but with now a classical phone, which is essentially what we had before. And there is one extra modification that we have to do to the system. As is, the problem is actually still impossible. We have to add one ingredient to the system, which is called entanglement. Roughly speaking, entanglement is a quantum object that consists of two parts. Part one is going to live in lab A, and the second part is going to be in lab B. And these are correlated in some crazy way, which I'll describe later. You've probably seen an example of entangled state earlier today, and we'll see another one as we progress through this talk. But I want to explore a little bit what are the consequences of this difference between the classical case that we're talking about a second ago. The first thing is that this entanglement actually will get destroyed in the teleportation process. And that will be important in a second. The second thing is that we need to figure out how to start off with this entanglement. How do you produce entanglement? Well, it's very simple. You take two particles, and one, if they're both in the same lab, you apply some operation to it, some transformation, some, you put it into some machine, and voila, you have two entangled particles. But that's not what we want. We want one of them in lab A and one of them in lab B. So we got to take the particle from lab A and carry it all the way over to lab B. Can we use teleportation to do that? Hey, that would make it easy. The answer is no. In principle, yes, we could use teleportation for that. But as I said, entanglement is something that gets destroyed when we do teleportation. So if we tried sending entanglement via teleportation, we would transmit one entangled state and destroy one entangled state, a net gain of zero. So that's not particularly useful. You also may have to ask, well, how did we get that very, very first entangled state across there? Now that's the problem. So how did we get that first state? Well, what has to have happened is that at some point in the past, this wall was not there. In the far, far past, there was no wall. The scientists from Lab A and Lab B, this was before the wall in Berlin, to get together in a coffee shop somewhere and talk. And somebody put together an entangled state, and one of the technicians from Lab B carried it over to Lab B. Time passed, and somebody built the wall, and now they can't move things regularly, but now they can use the entangled state that they previously prepared sometime before the wall was built. Maybe I can give you an example of this in more practical terms. Say you have two friends who are living together in the same town, and one of them now is going to move far away across the continent. So he says to his buddy, hey, we've been friends for a while. How about, we share an entangled state? Maybe that sounds a little bit dirty, but I guarantee you. Perfectly safe. So, okay, so that's what they do. Right before leaving, they share this entangled state. His friend carries over his entangled state over with him wherever he goes. And now they can use this for teleportation once they're far apart. Perfect. The question is now, okay, where can you teleport to? Well, let's assume that you did this with all of your friends. You have entangled states shared between you and each of your friends. So in principle, you could use your entangled state to teleport to any of the labs of your friends. You could simply use their teleportation machine to teleport to the labs of their friends. So you can teleport to the lab of your friends, your friends' friends, your friends' friends' friends, your friends' 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 friends, and you see how the pattern is going to continue forever. However, if there's somebody who hasn't shared teleportation entanglement with you, and with nobody you know, then you can't teleport to their lab. So if we wanted to teleport to, say, visit the aliens in Alpha Centauri or something like that, we can't do that. We're stuck. We've never shared teleportation with them, or we've never shared entanglement with them, so we can't do this. Okay, so that's the first part. We can only teleport places that are connected by entanglement. But the other thing that I told you is that entanglement gets used up in the teleportation process. So when you start off, when you take your entanglement with you, you know, after leaving your friend, you gotta bring enough. Enough for as many teleportations as you want. Once you've run out of it, you gotta go visit your friend again in person and carry personally the entanglement back to your lab. Is this good if you gotta keep, you know, visiting your friend to, you know, carry entanglement? Well, you think about it like this. Let's assume that the trek to visit your friend who's far away is very difficult. One trek, which is very difficult, can allow you to carry many, many entangled pairs, which can be used for many, many trips that are pain-free, or relatively pain-free, as you learn, through the entanglement machine, through the teleportation machine. So one difficult trip can allow lots of easy trips later. Yes, question?
If you take a trip there, and then take entangled states, and then take the long trip back?
Oh, yes.
So that would save you half a trip.
Well, do you also use up some entangled states doing that? So you need to carry some more back.
Yeah.
Yes, but yes, absolutely. Roughly speaking, there's sort of one leg that needs to be done, you know, on foot, we call it that. Okay, so that's basically what this entanglement does to the quantum problem. It makes it a little bit different, it makes it a little bit more interesting. You have to be aware of your entanglement, you have to know who you share it with, and how much you have. Yes, question?
So I'm entanglement, and I teleport somewhere. Do I lose all the entanglement I have with me, or just that I use?
No, actually, it turns out that entanglement comes in units. You've heard of qubits, hopefully, which is the fundamental unit of quantum information. Entanglement comes in units of ebits. We like making up silly names like that. One ebit is the amount of entanglement needed to teleport one qubit. It's also the amount of entanglement that you can carry in one qubit. So it does come in sort of sizes. The bigger the object you're trying to teleport, the more entanglement you need. You only need to consume the amount of entanglement, you know, dependent on the size of the object that you're teleporting. Yes, question?
Can I just confirm that you said you can bring entanglement back to the entangled particle by teleporting yourself from A to B?
Oh, sure. That sounds okay.
When you do that, wouldn't you be destroying the entanglement of the particles you're carrying because they're being measured to be teleported?
You can't. You're starting off, say, in B. You have some entanglement, but, you know, just running out. So you use your last entanglement to teleport over here. Now you're both here. You create new entanglement here. And the difficulty is carrying it over. And now you have to walk over on foot carrying this entanglement to lab B.
Couldn't you teleport?
No.
No, because it takes one ebit to teleport one ebit. So you always have a net gain of zero in the teleportation game. Question.
About how many ebits does that qubit?
One ebit to qubit, one qubit to ebit.
So you only, isn't it possible that there's some data loss in the transmission? You know what I mean? Like any errors?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but this goes back to the same concept of the fax machine. I want to make a fax machine that's very, very accurate, not perfectly accurate.
Yeah, but if you had like 5 ebits per qubit, then
could you make some more
majority rules for what information is passed? You know what I mean?
Like, it's a little bit more complicated, but yes, you could improve the accuracy by using wasting more key bits. Yes. One last question.
So, can you, like, if I have, say, twice as much tangles as I need, can I use half of that to get to lab A, and the stuff I carried with me will all be used up, or just the stuff I needed to get there?
You just use the thing you need. It comes in units, you just consume what you need. It's kind of like energy. You know, if you only run your television for an hour, you only use 1 hour of battery. It's exactly the same concept. Okay, moving on. There's one extra thing that I should point out with quantum teleportation, which is really interesting. In the classical case, remember we wanted to destroy Kumar after he was teleported to Lab B. We didn't want two of them. But that seemed kind of optional. I mean, maybe we're teleporting somewhere else. You know, maybe if we're Einstein, we really would like two Einsteins, one in Lab A and one in Lab B. It would actually come in handy. So can we do that in a quantum case? Well, it turns out in the quantum case, this shredding stuff is not optional. You cannot make copies of a quantum object. It's called the no-cloning theorem. There can only be, at any time, one copy of any quantum object. So it is impossible to teleport an object to Lab B without first destroying it in Lab A. It is not optional in the quantum case. Philosophically, maybe this is kind of interesting, because you say, well, if there's only one copy of Kumar at any time, and he safely arrived in Lab B, then whatever is destroyed in Lab A could not have been him. But that's really a question of morality, which will lead to the philosophers. What we're going to do now is do mathematics. So I want to briefly try to do the mathematics of teleportation, and we're going to talk about teleporting just one spin, the spin of one electron. We're not even going to teleport its momentum, we're not going to teleport its position, we're just going to make sure that I'm going to have an electron in an electron over here, I'm going to have an electron over here, and I want to make sure that the state of the electron in Lab B after teleportation is the same as the state of the electron in Lab A before teleportation. I should put one last note to this, is that when I'm teleporting, I don't teleport matter and energy. Just like you wouldn't use a fax machine to send blank paper. If somebody's running out of paper, you don't fax the paper. What I'm assuming is that in Lab B, they have enough energy and matter to produce anything they want. All I want to do is the teleportation is supposed to tell me how to assemble that energy and matter into the pattern of whatever object was placed in Lab A. Matter and energy are never transferred in teleportation, at least in this version of teleportation. Okay. So let's talk about one spin. So, for some reason, they never teach us in physics classes, but you've probably heard this in your chemistry class, that electrons have something called spin. What does that mean in practice? Well, it means that there's this machine called a Stern-Gerlach machine. Stern-Gerlach. I think that's probably. We'll assume it properly spelled. And what it does is you put an electron into the machine. And there are two things that can happen. It can come flying out upwards and hit the wall over here. And we call these the plus a half electrons. Something else can happen, or up electrons. It can go flying down after it leaves the machine. We call this the minus a half spin electrons, or sometimes the down spin electrons. So this tells us that this Stern-Gerlach machine can sort electrons into two piles, the up electrons and the down electrons. So it tells us that in quantum mechanics, there are two states for the electron spin. There is the up spin and the down state. These are kets. I think you're all familiar with this. This is not a greater than sign. These are just vector denoting states. So if we can have an up state and a down state, the rules of quantum mechanics tell us that we can also have a sum of these two things. a superposition, if you will. A up plus B down. Okay, so what happens if I put an A up plus B down electron inside this Stern-Gerlach machine?
Go straight.
Can it go here?
Yeah.
No. Here? Here? Who thinks that it goes here? Raise your hand. Who thinks that it goes there? Who thinks that it goes here? Who thinks that it goes here? I think that none of those are correct. Well, it's... Yes, I don't think none of those are strictly correct, as I said. Strictly correct. All right. What this says is that if we put that in here, we get a probability, magnitude A squared, of arriving at the top place, and magnitude B squared of arriving at the bottom spot. We never, ever, ever see it in the middle, up or down, anywhere else. In particular, if A is 1 and B is 0, well, then that's exactly our opposite. I mean, if A is 0 and B is 1, then that's our downstream that we started with.
Okay, A is 1 and B is 1.
Well, the question now is, can A and B both be 1? Well, if this is the probability of being up here, and if this is the probability of being down here, then we know that magnitude of A squared plus magnitude of B squared equals 1. Okay, well that's fairly simple. Let's complicate things a little bit. There is a second Stern-Gerlach experiment, which sorts things not into spin up and spin down, but sorts electrons into spin left and spin right. So there is a spin right, and there is a spin left. And there is a different Stern-Gerlach experiment that will sort your electrons into these cases. Do we need to introduce two new vectors to do this? Well, no. These vectors are actually related to the old vectors by very simple equations. Spin right is 1 over root 2 spin up plus 1 over root 2 spin down. Spin left is 1 over root 2 spin up minus 1 over root 2 spin down. So, if I have a spin right, and I put it in the original Stern-Gerlach experiment, we're going to call this a measurement in the z basis of a vertical basis. What's the probability of getting up? A half. What's the probability of getting down? What if I start with a left spin? A half. It's not even minus. It's not minus a half because we take the magnitude. The minus has other things. But it doesn't change the probability here. Yes, question?
Could it be 1 over root 2 or 1 over root 2 squared? Since it's 50% of the
root. It's 1 over root 2 because the probability is not this number. It's this number magnitude squared. So 1 over root 2 squared is 1 half. So I want the square of this number to be a half, rather than this number to be a half. Okay. So, we can invert these equations, and you can do this manually, but I'll just tell you what the answer is. And it basically says that we can rewrite the up and the down spin in terms of the left and the right spin. The up is 1 over root 2 right plus 1 over root 2 left. And the down spin is 1 over root 2 right minus 1 over root 2 left. Okay, now if I started off with an upspin, and I measured in the x basis with this other Stern-Gerlach experiment, which measures in the x direction, or x basis, what's the probability of getting spin right? 50%, or half. What's the probability of getting spin left? Okay, good. You know what we've just proven? The uncertainty principle for spins. What does this tell us? If we know whether there's an up and down spin, if we know whether there's going to be an up spin or a down spin, We have no idea what the outcome is going to be when I put it in a left or right stern Gerlach experiment. We have no idea whether it's a left or a right spin. If we know that it's a left spin or we know that it's a right spin, we have no idea whether it's an up spin or a down spin. We have no idea what will happen when we put it inside this stern Gerlach experiment. So we can only know, we can know the value of the spin in the vertical direction, but not in the x direction, or we can know the value of the spin in the x direction, but not in the vertical direction. It's the same thing as the uncertainty principle for position and momentum, but now it's for the x component of the spin and the z component of the spin. It's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle for spins. Now, I have to tell you one very important rule of quantum measurement, which you might have heard, but if not, you're just going to have to believe me now. After you measure something, the original state is destroyed and is converted into whatever the outcome of the measurement is. So if I start with a spin right, and I dump it into this Stern-Gerlach experiment, and I get an outcome up here, and it flies up all the way here, and I get a spin up, after the experiment is done, the spin will be a spin up. And the information as to whether it was left or right is lost. If I started from left, there's a 50 probability percent it's been up here, here as well. After that, it will be up as well. If I start from up, there's a 100% probability it's going to start here, and it'll still be an up. Okay. Well, now we want to play a little game. Now one of your friends is going to come and give you one of these four spins. He's going to challenge you to tell him which one it is. Well, if it's, you know that it's one of these two, you can measure on the z basis and know and guess with certainty which of the two it is. If you know that it's definitely one of these two, you can measure on the x basis and know with certainty which one it is. But if you don't know which of the four it is, it could be any of the four, then say you measure the z basis, well, you'll get the right answer for these two. But for these two, you'll have no idea what happened. And after the first measurement, you'll have destroyed the state and it's gone forever. And you'll never be able to find out what it was. You can measure in the x basis, you can measure, there are lots of other measurements I could point out, and just measuring in the z basis or in the x basis. But no matter what measurement you choose, you will never be able to know with certainty which of the four possible states you gave. This is what I meant, that by quantum mechanics, we can never use measurements to fully identify a system. See, Kumar could be, if he were a spin, he could be one of these four spins. If we tried to teleport him first by measuring him and then sending the answer over, we wouldn't know which basis to measure. We could measure in this basis, up, down. We get the up, we say, building up. But what if it was a right spin or a left spin? Oh, sorry again. So this is basically the problem that quantum teleportation is trying to address. We can't figure out which of those four possibilities are spin is by measurement. Nevertheless, we have to get the right, teleport the right answer over to lab B. Okay, that's what the mathematics of one spin. What about the mathematics of two spins? Well, if we have two spins, well, then we have, if we're looking at the z basis states, we have each of them could be up, so there's going to be a state where both of them are up. There's going to be a state where the first one is up and the second one is down. There is a state where the first one is down and second one is up. And there's a state when they're both down. But quantum mechanics, again, tells us if I have four states, I can take some superpositions of these. What is A? If I were to measure both spins in the up in the vertical direction, A, magnitude A squared is the probability that I see two ups. Magnitude B squared is the probability that I see one, the first one up and the second one down. And so on and so on and so forth. Yes, question?
Is this two electrons?
So this is two electrons, yes. This is an equation that describes two electrons, each of which has a spin. And so this is the information about the spin of the first electron. This represents the information of the spin of the second electron. By our conservation of probabilities, or the fact that probability is always sum to 1, we have to have that magnitude A squared plus magnitude B squared plus magnitude C squared plus magnitude D squared equals 1. Okay. And I think you might have seen this earlier today, but just to make sure we have, everybody's on the same page. What happens if I only measure the first spin? What's the probability of observing the first spin up? And here half, but here a squared plus b squared. Quarter. Well, let me show you why it's not a quarter. I can choose a to be 0, b to be 0, c to be 0, and d to be 1. And that's consistent with this equation so far. And then the probability of measuring the first and the, if I measure them both, I get now. So surely, I could simply measure this one first and this one second, in which case, when I measure the first one, without having measured the second one, I must always get a down answer. So the probability in this case of seeing the first one up is 0. But that's a particular case. So it can't always be up. The correct answer is that we know that the probability is magnitude a squared for being in this state, and magnitude b squared for being in this state, and these are the two states where it's up, then the probability of seeing it up is the sum of these two things. So probability of up for spin 1 is magnitude a squared plus magnitude b squared. What is the state of the two spins after this measurement? Well, we've somehow damaged the state of the first spin. But we haven't really done anything to the second spin. The second spin shouldn't change. So we really want to say that we just want to take all the states that have up for the first spin and dump all the states that have down for the first spin. So the state should now be A, up, up, plus b, up, down. What's the problem with this state? No. What's the probability of observing up, up? Somebody? A squared. Magnitude a squared. What's the probability of observing up down? Magnitude b squared. What's the sum of the two possible outcomes I could get? Well, it should be 1, but is it 1? Well, it's not 1, because c and d may be something. So this is cannot be the correct answer. So the answer is actually fixed by a small technicality, we divide by the square root of magnitude a squared plus magnitude b squared. Okay, this won't be all that important, but this is what actually happens. This is what it gets converted to. You have to change the normalization so that it sums to 1. Now, this quantity, magnitude squared, plus this quantity, magnitude squared, does actually equal 1. Yes?
I'm saying B can be a value since you've already measured the first spin to be up.
Excuse me?
You've already measured the first spin to be up.
Yes.
So it can't, so C and B can have a value.
Yes, so.
So this equation has the first row, right?
Well, this is the same. This is a little bit of mathematical notation. A and B are not always a coefficient that sits here and here. A and B are some numbers that I'm going to give you later. Right? And then a and b here are the same numbers that we had in this equation. So we know that the whole number that sits in front of here has to, magnitude squared plus the whole number that sits here has to be. But this state is before measurement. And so a, b, c and d don't necessarily have to be 0 before the measurement. And they don't change. These are just numbers that I give you. They don't change because of the measurement. The state changes. But the numbers, the values of a, b, c, and d do not change because of the measurement. Does that roughly make sense? The state changes. These are just parameters that I put in. I get to choose them any way I want. Okay. So now it's time for our very first entangled state. Let me give it a name. the singlet state. One over root two up down minus one over root two down up. This is a state of two electrons. So what's the probability if I measure the first one and only the first one, what's the probability of seeing up? A half. What's the probability of seeing, if I measure only the first one, of seeing down? What's the probability if I only measure the second one of seeing up? If I only measure the second one of seeing down? Okay, so it appears that we have no knowledge of what the state is of the first one. We have no knowledge of what the state is of the second one. But now, let's say I measure the state of the first one and I get up. What will be the outcome of the state if I measure the second spin? Down. So I know nothing about the first one, I know nothing about the second one. But as soon as I measure the first one, I know exactly what the second one is. Is this crazy or what? Who thinks this is a crazy quantum phenomenon? Raise your hand. Who thinks this is a standard everyday thing that, anybody could have seen before? I'll actually raise my hand to this one. You actually could have seen this before if you tried harder. Here's how you do this. Take a friend and ask him to draw either a spin up or a spin down on a piece of paper without actually telling you what it is. Take that piece of paper without looking at it and run it through a photocopier. Now, you don't know what the first paper says. You don't know what the second paper says. But as soon as you see either one, you know what's on the other one. Now maybe you'll say, okay, but here they're always opposite. Well, we can easily fix that. Take one of the papers and rotate them by 180 degrees. Same thing. Okay, so what's different about this entangled state is that when I had the papers of the spin, there's only one way to look at them. There's only one way to measure them. I flip over the spin and that's it. When I have the singlet state, there are actually many ways to measure the singlet state. I can measure it in the z-basis, but I can also measure it in the x-basis, which we discussed over there. Measure whether it's left or right. I can also measure in many other bases. If I measure in any direction, any of the spins, I always get 50-50 outcomes. However, if I measure both spins in the same direction, I always get opposite outcomes for any direction, not just the vertical direction. And this is what makes this quantum entanglement slightly different from standard classically correlated optics. Okay. There's one last thing that I need to discuss before we can actually get teleportation, and it's the notion of unitary operators. So far, all we've ever done with quantum states is measurement. Measurement gives us some amount of information about the state, but destroys the state afterwards. There's a set of operations which sort of do the opposite. Give us no information about the state, but don't destroy any of the quantum information in it. You're probably accustomed to such ideas. The simplest example of a unitary is a rotation. Let's imagine a rotation around the x-axis by 180 degrees. What should that do? Well, if I have an upspin, and I rotate it by 180 degrees around the x-axis, what should it turn into? If I have a downspin, what should it go to? Up. We call this operation the x operator. Fortunately enough that it has its own name. On a general superposition, x acting on A up plus B down, this goes to A down plus B up. There's another very important operation called the Z operation. What is the Z operation? It's a rotation around the Z axis by 180 degrees. What should the Z operation do on an upspin? Nothing. What should the Z operator do on a downspin? Surprisingly, it turns out that answer is wrong. A Z acting on A up plus B down does the following. On the up spin, it does nothing, so it leaves the first term invariant. On the down spin, however, it puts an extra minus sign. So we get minus B down.
Why?
Why is a very good question. Unfortunately, why is beyond the scope of this course. I can tell you that this doesn't change the relative probability, because if you're taking magnitude squared of this quantity, then magnitude squared of this quantity or magnitude squared of minus this quantity is exactly the same thing. So it doesn't actually change the relative probability. The effect of this minus sign is something else, but I won't be able to talk to you about it today. If you look carefully, actually, at the x operator, it leaves the right spin invariant, but it actually puts a minus sign on the left spin as well. So they're actually symmetric. Okay, there's one last final operation that we need to do before learning about teleportation. Oh, before I go on to this, how do I know that these don't destroy the quantum state? They don't.
Because you're changing the quantum direction.
Because I can undo them. How do I undo a rotation around the x-axis by 180 degrees? I do it again. Rotate it by another 180 degrees. If I do this twice, I get the same thing back. So they can't be destroying any quantum information. I can undo them. Anything that I can undo surely does not damage the quantum state. Final operation is called the controlled x, sometimes abbreviated cx. And it acts on two spins at a time. There's A up, up, plus B up, down, plus C down, up, plus D down, down. So what does it do? Well, on the first one, it does absolutely nothing. Up, up saves invariant. On the second one, it does absolutely nothing. Up, down stays the same. On the third one, it switches the second spin. And on the fourth one, it switches the second spin as well. So what this does is, if the first spin is up, it does nothing to the second spin. If the first spin is down, it flips the second spin. Well, there's an obvious way of doing this. Simply, we measure the first spin, and then condition on that result. We either apply an x or not to the second spin. But that would actually destroy the state. It turns out that we can do this operation without doing any measurements in the laboratory, so long as we have both spins in the same laboratory right next to each other. Small technicality. Okay, out of these operations and those measurements that we had over there, we're going to build our quantum teleportation device. So, setup for teleportation is as follows. There are three spins. Spin one is the unknown spin. What do I mean by unknown? Well, it could be an up spin, it could be a down spin, it could be a right spin, it could be a left spin. In fact, it could be anything else. But let's just worry about those four cases today. It starts off in lab A. Spin 2 and spin 3 are entangled. So spin 2 is the first spin of the singlet state, and spin 3 is the second spin of the singlet state. Spin 2 is going to start off in lab A. And spin 3 is going to start in lab B. What is the teleportation protocol going to do? Well, at the end of it, we're still going to have two spins in lab A and one spin in lab B. As I said, we don't move matter and we don't move energy. We move states. The goal of teleportation is that no matter what the original state of spin A was, of spin 1 was, at the end of teleportation, the state of spin 3 will be exactly that. So if we start with an up spin here, we end with an up spin in spin 3. If we start with a right spin here, we end with a right spin in spin 3. Left spin, so on and so on and so forth. So there are 5 steps to quantum teleportation. And these I'll just copy down to make sure I get them right. So, 5 steps. Number 1, we apply a controlled X operator to spins 1 and 2. I said that they had to be in the same laboratory for you to apply a controlled X, but they are in the same laboratory, so that's good. We measure in step 2. Spin 2 in the Z basis. Step 3, we measure spin 1 in the X basis. Step 4 is the telephone call. Remember a telephone a long time ago? We're doing 2 measurements, both of which occur in lab A. In fact, all 3 steps, the first 3 steps can be done in lab A. The measurements are going to give you some outcomes. You're then going to, lab A is going to call up lab B on the phone and say, hey, I've done the measurements. These are the results of the measurements. I got, say, left, right, or something like that. Finally, in step B, in the 5th step, in lab B, they do the following. B, they do. So, if the outcome of spin 1 was something, and spin 2 was something, remember we measured both of these, we'll do to spin 3, and here's the approximate table to help fill it. So if it's left, and if it's down, we do nothing. If it's right and down, we do the Z operator, the Z unitary that's right over there. First one is right, the second one is left. Then we have right again and up, in which case you do an X operator. And finally we have left and then up, in which case we do an X operator and then a Z operator. And that's it. That's teleportation. So we're running mostly out of time, so if I'm going to check one case. In principle, if we wanted to teleport one of those 4 states, there are 4 things we could teleport. There are 4 outcomes of the measurements you can get. That gives us 16 different possible things to check. Out of the 16, I will check one of them. And those who are really interested can go home and check the other 15. And I'm sure all of you will do. Okay. So very, very briefly, so we start with a spin up. That's what we're trying to teleport. We want, at the end of the day, spin 3 to be up. So spin 1. And we have the entangled state. Their combined state, when you put these 2 together, is simply 1 over root 2. First spin is up, second spin is up, third spin is down, minus 1 over root 2, up, down, up. So you put two different states into one big mega state. Okay, so this is our starting point. So step one, what happens? Well, I'm supposed to apply a controlled knock, which means I'm supposed to do nothing if this first spin is up. Okay, so let's do nothing. We have the same state now. So step one, we end up with the same thing. Step two, we're going to measure spin two in the z-basis. So let's assume I got the up outcome. What is the state after that? Well, it's up, up, down. Because we take away the other thing and we renormalize to one. Now we get step three. I'm going to measure this in the left basis or the right basis. Well, I can rewrite this state as 1 over root 2 right up down plus 1 over root 2 left up down, simply by the rules we had up there. Let's say I measure this and I get the right outcome. So now the spin, the state of the three spins is going to be right, up, down. And here we got the up outcome. Step four, I call up my buddy in lab two and I say, hey, what did I get? I got up and I got right. Up, right, I look at the table, it says, apply an X to the spin. So he goes, and in step five, he applies an X operator to spin three. What's that going to do? It was down. What do I get now? Up. What did I want? Up. And I started with an up spin, and I got an up spin. And that's one of the 16 cases that, in principle, you have to check to prove teleportation. All the other ones work basically the same.
That's only for spin. What for momentum?
This is for spin. General, you can take these ideas and generalize them and teleport momentum as well. But that's definitely beyond the scope of today's course.
Position
the same thing. Position and momentum sort of get teleported together. Okay, before we close, let me just ask you one question. How fast is teleportation? Instantaneous. Is it really?
The speed of communication.
It can't beat the speed of communication. We have this one step, which is important here, which is the telephone step. So it can't be faster than whatever you're using for a telephone. Now, all telephones travel at the speed of light. So you can't actually complete the teleportation experiment faster than the speed of light. So you can't use teleportation to travel faster than the speed of light. In principle, this could be slower. If, you know, your measurement and reconstruction is slower. But at a minimum, it can't be faster than the speed of light. Yes, Mark?
Yes, but isn't it using the entanglement? Isn't it using the entanglement to send the information?
But you need a telephone.
But it turns out, and this is a very subtle point, that until you apply the correction operators, what you have in the last spin is garbage. It doesn't have any message. So even though it appears that the last spin jumped and change the state instantaneously, when you do the calculation carefully, it turns out that that contains no information, and that you can't extract any information from that, and that you only get information, or you only get to teleport people, until after you completed the fifth step, this correction operators, which means after the telephone call. Okay. So, can we do teleportation in principle? Well, there actually have been some experiments that teleport spins, exactly what we did here on the board. So let me show you two slides before we finish. And in the meantime, are there any questions while I turn on this machine?
Is this what you do?
Yeah.
This what I do, this is related to what I do. This problem is obviously solved, essentially. So I'm not working in a solved problem anymore, but there are other open problems that are related to it.
Like what?
I'm going to have a hard time describing that right now. I'll happily talk about that at tea, at 3 o'clock. Or wine and cheese, which maybe we're not too sure if you want it. Okay. So, and that's not the one I wanted, but this is basically a teleportation experiment. I lost for the first one. So the first teleportation experiment, this one, was in 1997, and they teleported something, a spin, the distance of approximately 50 centimeters. What does that mean? Well, they had a table over there, and lab A is roughly the left side of the table, and lab B is the right side of the table, and they teleported stuff from the left side of the table to the right side of the table. Nevertheless, that essentially proved the teleportation was possible in principle. Yes, questions? Oh. Lights. Okay, so that's basically what the setup looks like. There's a happy, I'm assuming, a graduate student there looking at a table. That's a table filled with lasers, which is essentially what they use for this particular teleportation experiment. I'll just show you one last slide. Move fast forward to 2004, and now we can teleport, 600 meters all across, a large river. But roughly speaking, this is the state of the art. We can't teleport very far. We can't teleport very much. We can teleport maybe one spin, maybe two spins. Still, I would say that within 30 years, we will likely be able to teleport thousands of spins. Why? Because if we ever build a quantum computer, the same technology that allows us to build a quantum computer, which I'm hoping will appear within 30 to 50 years, could teleport thousands of spins. Will we ever able to teleport people? Probably not. Teleporting a person is a much, much, much harder problem than teleporting a thousand spins. There are 10 to the 29 particles in a person, each of which has position momentum in addition to spin. So teleporting a thousand spins, yes. Teleporting 10 to the 29 particles, probably not. But nevertheless, what we've learned today here is that in principle, even if not in practice, it is possible to teleport people. Thank you. Well, that's really a philosophical question. It's not clear whether it's continuous or not. I think you could sort of make an argument for both sides if you really examine it carefully. But, these are philosophical questions, but I don't think I can provide you with much of an answer. If you want to picture it as the guy disappears and a new person who just happens to look exactly the same is created, then that's probably a valid point of view. If you want to picture it as the same person that teleported, that's also a valid point of view. No, I mean, in principle, I would believe that it would just work. It would walk out, wouldn't notice anything, and even perfectly happy. But since nobody's done the experiment, I can't actually tell it.